Welcome to Bubbla.
Well, hey, Carrie, I don't know about you, but man, I have been exhausted after work, more mentally than physically. And when I'm like that, I am just spent. I don't want to think, can't concentrate on TV. Do you ever go through that?
Oh, absolutely. You have your standards that you watch, just that kind of are mind-numbing or you've seen 100 times, right?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. So I remember an article coming out during the height of the pandemic. People were going back and watching old favorite television shows. I think it was Seinfeld, The Office, and Friends. Just some people rediscovering, some people just, like you said, mind-numbing things. And then I started seeing more research on it. This is something I found very interesting. It turns out that people with anxiety, which most of us had at one time or another during 2020, people with anxiety may rewatch shows as a coping mechanism to manage stress, emotions, and challenging situations. They say that rewatching a show can trigger positive emotions, provide a means of emotional regulation, and basically just kind of lets you shift your focus away from external pressures. It lowers your cognitive load. You enjoy the predictability, and there's a comfort of repetition. And I was thinking about it, and I've caught myself though in this rut, which is the same shows on and almost as background noise. And so I've tried to maybe find something new that still has some nostalgia, things like that. And then I thought of what you were talking about the other day. I think you said you had watched the Netflix documentary about the making of the album We Are the World.
Yes, The Greatest Night in Pop. You know, I stumbled upon it. I have had a newfound, and maybe it's not really new, but a little bit of a fascination over the last probably 6 years with Lionel Richie. Where did he go? He was so big. And in this documentary, which is fantastic, so if you haven't seen it, you have to watch it. But he was at the height of success when We Are the World, when they were recording that and wrote it, and he and Michael Jackson partnered together. He was hosting AMAs, I think. It was the award show.
Yeah, this was 1985. Lionel's on fire. He's probably one of the most recognizable artists at the time. And he was hosting the American Music Awards. He was everywhere.
And he won, I think, 8 or 9 awards that night or something wild. And here's the thing. He was literally dancing on the ceiling and then disappeared. And then he came back and it was like we saw Nicole Richie with Paris Hilton. He kind of was gone for a while. And then he started popping up on things. And then, of course, he's on American Idol now. He looks like he did in 1985. And I've just had this fascination with him. And when it started, I had forgotten because, you know, going back to 1985, it was a long time ago. And I had completely forgotten that he was part of writing We Are the World. I knew Michael Jackson had been part of it. Yeah.
I absolutely forgot his role. I just remember Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson.
Same. It was just fun reliving it. And I have visions of, you know, they had the video and you get excited to hear your favorite artist do their solo. So I really got into it. What I found to be interesting, though, is how they were selecting everybody. And I really hadn't put it all together because back, I guess, in my young years when this all happened, I knew all the players, you know, because it was all popular music. But as they were kind of talking through, I never realized that Kenny Loggins was there. There were these artists that I was like, holy crap, this was bigger than I even realized. When I was a kid, I thought it was cool that Bruce Springsteen was there and Cyndi Lauper. And how did Huey Lewis get a solo? Like, it was totally fascinating how they set this whole thing up. The production and the fact that they were able to get everybody in a studio and keep it secret for so long, they would never, ever be able to do that today.
See, that's what I think is the most interesting part of the documentary. And I did finally go watch it. In 1985, the technology was very different. As far as recording remotely and things like that, one of the first projects where they were doing people recording over previous recordings, Natalie Cole doing Unforgettable with her father, that was so mind-blowing back then. So like today, you could get a laundry list of artists together. They could all record in their home studio or a nearby studio, mix everything in. But in 1985, it would have never been done. That would have been a 2-year project. They considered an epic production ordeal. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting that the way they got the people all in the studio at once, taking them immediately after the American Music Awards. They didn't know where they were going because they had to keep the location confidential so it wasn't swarmed with media. Bam, bam, bam. It had to be meticulous. It had to be on time. It was over 40 musicians either driving themselves, shuttled, taking a limo. Uh-huh. A couple of them were not at the award show. They flew in, went all into one studio, and then all be herded together to record a song that some of them had only heard fragments of a demo. They weren't all coming in all polished up, ready to lay down their tracks and go. This was literally watching Lionel Richie herd cats.
It literally was amazing to see them be so starstruck with each other. To turn around and in all of it and then just see Bob Dylan in the middle. Just like, what? How is this even happening? They were all just starstruck. It was super cool. And I didn't realize, and I think you had brought this up at one point, the battle between Prince and Michael Jackson. I guess I just wasn't aware of it. Actually, that's not true. Here's what has happened. I was Michael Jackson, so I was not allowed to listen to Prince music. So, and I think we all know why, but I wasn't allowed. I had an older aunt who was only 9 years older than me, and she would play Prince music. And my mom was like, oh no, or that we need Carrie listening to. So maybe I shouldn't say I wasn't allowed. It just wasn't something that was played. Michael Jackson was definitely more common in my household. So I wasn't aware of this battle. And they were showing that they were up against each other in the awards. Michael Jackson wasn't at the AMAs that night. He was at the studio. And then, of course, Prince and his bodyguard, who, again, I have no recollection of ever seeing that dude. He obviously took away. I think he went home with all of them, if not most.
The rivalry, and I highly recommend, if you just Google it, you can go down some amazing rabbit holes when it comes to Prince versus Michael Jackson. They actually did not dislike each other as much as people have alluded to, but to say they were competitive is the understatement of the decade. Like, they attended an event, you know, and you're giving your rider for what you want in your dressing room is Michael Jackson. The first thing you're asking is, well, what did Prince get? And vice versa. That's how they were competitive, doing this thing where they were always measuring themselves up against each other. Not to go too far off this rabbit hole, but I'll tell you, no one ever called Michael Jackson the King of Pop before Michael Jackson called himself the King of Pop. That was a sore spot with Prince, because obviously, if you think about the implications, Prince's name is Prince. That's his name as an artist. Prince Rogers Nelson is his full name. Michael Jackson self-proclaimed himself the King of Pop just to say, I am the king, you may be the prince. That's how that rivalry was. They were two stories to why Prince wasn't there. The first one, which was discussed in the documentary by Sheila E., because she was really used as a pawn to try to pull Prince into that recording.
Absolutely. I mean, at one point she said she was getting a solo and she didn't get, I'm fairly certain she didn't get a solo, but
she did not. Yeah. She had been at the AMAs and they were kind of thinking that, yeah, she could Prince call, things like that. But her side of the story, as far as why Prince didn't attend, is just solely the fact that he hates crowds. He wasn't comfortable. There is a part in the documentary where he says, you know, I'd love to come in and do a guitar solo, another part of the studio. So that was him volunteering to participate. They said it wasn't necessary. Honestly, they didn't have time.
No, they had no time. Are you kidding?
That's her side. Wendy of the Revolution has said that just Prince point blank didn't think it was a good song. He offered to write his own song. I guess there's actually a lyric in a song by Prince. It's a B-side where he mentions that he would write the song instead of being on their songs. Yeah, he's even made a quick reference to it.
Isn't that crazy?
You mentioned that Michael Jackson did not attend the AMAs, and he was there before, and it looked like he was helping set up. And, you know, he did co-write the song, but let's be honest, they were recording not only the video, but a documentary about it. There's a beautiful shot of Michael Jackson singing all by himself in an empty studio that was recorded before everyone got there, who he really thought about not doing the song. He wanted to he was willing to write it. Thriller was blowing up so much that he was afraid it was overexposure. He knows that not only is Prince going scheduled to be in there, but he and Prince are actually going to sing back to back. And you asked earlier, why did Huey Lewis get a solo? Because Huey Lewis sang the part that was written for Prince. It was right after Michael Jackson.
Really? That makes sense. Oh my goodness, look at you hitting me. That's cool. Because that was all the high parts too, because it was like they were going in and out with like Kenny Loggins, Steve Perry. It was like that whole up and down. And then Huey Lewis was trying to keep up with Cyndi Lauper and who was it? Kim Carnes, I think.
Yeah. So listen to the list. Just the soloists alone. You had Lionel Richie, Stevie Wonder, Paul Simon, Kenny Rogers, James Ingram, Tina Turner, Billy Joel, Michael Jackson, Diana Ross, Dionne Warwick, Willie Nelson, a drunken Al Jarreau, Bruce Springsteen.
Oh my God, that was nuts.
Denny Loggins, Steve Perry, not too long after that, disappeared. Daryl Hall, Huey Lewis, who again was not originally supposed to have a solo. He took Prince's part. Cyndi Lauper, Ken Carnes, Bob Dylan, and Ray Charles. And the Bob Dylan segment of the documentary, I kind of felt nostalgic and a little heartwarmed. It was kind of really weird for me, but it was kind of an awe moment because Bob Dylan was so nervous and scared because none of that was his style of music. And he just sits there so quiet and nervous. He and Stevie Wonder get together and Stevie Wonder brings out, I think, Springsteen and Dylan's kind of little ad libs are some of the highlights of the song.
Absolutely, it is. Absolutely. You can't tell me otherwise. I stand on that. Okay.
What did you think of this song? Let's talk about the nostalgia piece, though. What did you think of it? What do you remember about it as a child in 1985?
I remember it coming out and being a very big deal. So my dad was very big into music. We heard everything, and rock music predominantly, radio always on, always. I don't ever remember a minute going by where there wasn't music playing in the house. So when it came out, he was into it. My mom was into it. Everybody. We had the vinyl. I think it was a single, if I remember. So whenever it broke, am I remembering this right or am I making up a memory? Well, did the video come out soon after? Did it all release at the same
time? It all came out at the same time. As a matter of fact, the song was actually released at the same time and played on radios worldwide simultaneously. And that's why it was the fastest selling single in the United States. And it sold out its first 1 million copies like that. Again, and this was considered cutting edge technology back then to be able to have all these radio stations across the world play the song at exactly 7:59 a.m.
And I also remember the Feed the World with Bob Geldof. I remember that because that was really popular in the, you know, whatever station, you know, in Massachusetts and Boston that my family listened to. That was very popular. Everyone really excited about their favorite artists. And I remember the solos were the biggest deal to us as kids.
I have known you almost 25 years now, and I didn't know that you grew up in a household where your dad loved music so much, because so did I. My dad was actually a Bob Geldof fan. So when Band-Aid, Do They Know It's Christmas came out the year before in 1984, my dad bought out every local record store of that release and gave it as gifts. That was really my household's jam. And it was the same thing. It was such an incredible mix. Duran Duran and George Michael, Bono, Phil Collins, Boy George, Sarah Dallin, Geldof. And as a matter of fact, Paul McCartney and David Bowie couldn't make the recording, so they're actually on a B-side greeting. To me, you know, Phil Collins, John Taylor on bass. It was a little bit of a different project to raise funds for Ethiopia. They admit that that absolutely is what inspired We Are the World. It was not only Al Jarreau, you know, really started with Harry Belafonte. He saw what Geldof had done and he's like, you know, we can do this. And it grew into Willie Nelson being on it, Kim Carnes.
Kenny Rogers. I mean,
and it was like real Kenny. So talk about nostalgia. And I did. And to be honest with you, I didn't even recognize Willie Nelson. I kept looking at him during the documentary. I'm like, I know him, but I don't know him. And then it dawned on me. I was like, oh, you idiot.
And he's another one that at first you look at the list and you're like, really, Willie Nelson? And his solo, his voice is perfect on it. But it was such a great eclectic mix. A lot of people don't realize that there were so many more projects that were inspired by the We Are the World project. They realized, well, wait a minute. Artists have the ability and the power to not only raise awareness, but raise funds for causes. And so that's when you saw this huge spike, U2 promoting Amnesty International. Jerry Garcia actually had ties to raise money for the World Wildlife Federation. I didn't become aware of Greenpeace until the 80s, but did you know that James Taylor and Joni Mitchell were actually huge factors in the growth of Greenpeace in 1972?
Yes. Yeah.
Farm Aid, of course. And then one that I almost forgot about, A Very Special Christmas. Not only did I get to remember all those great things about all that music growing up and those different musicians that you forget about, like seeing Steve Perry in that, I'm going to go listen to some old Journey later.
You're probably going to get this wrong and I don't have the details in front of me. So come for me if you want to. Don't Stop Believing. I believe that just made the number one played song right now. It's like in history or something like that. I just heard that on my way to work the other day, and they were talking about Steve Perry, and yeah, man, that voice is amazing. I miss that voice.
If you grew up in the 80s, I highly recommend watching this documentary because watching something different at the end, it kind of turned into this cool little feel good movie.
Mick, I need to address the elephant in the room though. Why was Dan Aykroyd there?
So a lot of people don't realize that Dan Aykroyd actually has a strong musical background there that is not lip syncing in the film The Blues Brothers that he did with John Belushi.
Those movies.
And he still does different versions of The Blues Brothers. And this was also, I believe, Ghostbusters was a number one movie right around then. So Dan Aykroyd was actually in the height of his popularity. He was actually a Hollywood power player at the time who loved and still loves music. Yeah, that was the one that you're kind of like, Dan Aykroyd, no shit. When you're looking at it.
It was like, how are you in one breath saying, I want to get Bette Midler, I want to get Huey Lewis, Cyndi Lauper, and Dan Aykroyd? Like, that was actually something that somebody said. And Dan Aykroyd, I'm like, what? What a cool moment for him. He's probably like, can you believe I was in We Are the World?
Yeah, I mean, that's a guy that got to be a true fan and involved in a great project. And that was the other thing that was cool about this doc. And then we'll wrap it up. But seeing musicians, not only as people, there's first thing they see when they walk into the studio is Lionel Richie made a handwritten sign that said, check your ego at the door. It was just them in the studio. They weren't allowed to have their assistants with them. So they all had to go in. And you could see some of them were nervous. Some of them were like, I don't want to show the magic behind the curtain, you know, and some of them were open. Huey Lewis is like, wait, you want me to jump in on these high octave harmonies? That's not my wheelhouse, you know, and all these peers are staring at him while they try to figure that out. It was really cool just to see them as people, but also get to see them appreciate being fans of the other musicians in the room and getting their lyric sheets signed. And there are a few in there that if you go and look, LaToya Jackson, it was in there. There are a few that it's kind of like they were lucky to be there. And let's just leave it at that.
Agreed. But it was fantastic.
I appreciate you you turning me on to this one. Just thought it'd be a straightforward documentary. I didn't think I'd be as excited about it as I was. And I really got into it. And then at the very end, you see the In Memory Of and all the artists that are no longer with us. And there were a couple of them that I forgot had passed. So it was kind of like, wow. It was a good experience. I think it was a great call. And I think we better get back to work.
Yep. Let's go.
All rise.
It's time for Mick Makes the Call.
All right, Carrie, I'm excited. I believe you have another case for Mick Makes the Call.
I do, Mick. Are you ready for this one?
All right. I'm ready.
Okay. So one of my coworkers made brownies. We were very excited about the brownies. Not that kind of brownie, Nick. Just a regular can of brownies. It's the office now. A coworker made a can of brownies and brought it to the office. And she was running a little late. So she went down to the break room and she put the pan down and had to go back and jump into a meeting. So she left the pan of brownies out. No note, no nothing, still covered. When we went back to enjoy the brownies, someone had already started cutting the brownies. And we were like, oh, okay, we're going to enjoy some brownies. Somebody took it upon themselves to start slicing. Upon removing the cover, we discovered that the middle brownie was missing.
What, were the cut marks all in place in just the middle, or was just the middle cut out with no other lines?
There was a square, just a square. So it wasn't a scoop. We didn't just like go in with a spoon and go for the middle. It was a perfect square in the middle.
But it was carved as just a single square. Correct. There weren't edge to edge carvings covering the whole sheet.
Yes.
Okay.
So what I would like to know is this square maker at fault? Should they have cut the brownies and taken the edge piece first? Or is it okay to select the middle piece right off the bat? To me, that's not how you cut brownie. And you either cut them all and you go from the edge and you take one out and you keep going until you have a middle piece. And if everyone's gathered round and you prefer the middle piece, or let's talk sheet cake, you want to flour up the cake, you wait till it's cut and everybody goes about and asks for the piece. Because some people, hey, you know, you like a crunchy brownie, you want the side piece. You know, you might not like frosting on the sheet cake, so you don't want, you know, one with a lot of frosting. Going for the middle or actually cutting it? What is the correct way to cut a sheet cake or a pan of brownies mix?
So this is a two-fold case here. We'll call the individual who cut the center square. I'm going to take the center square for 1,000. We're going to call them the defendant. First and foremost, of course, the proper etiquette in this situation is if you have the confidence to go in and say, hey, these brownies are obviously for all of us, be the person that goes in and cuts them up so you can have a slice yourself. Common etiquette would be that you would cut them, or, you know, cut at least like a section, whether it's half or a third, where you slice them up into pieces. But I wouldn't do the whole thing just because some people might like larger pieces, some smaller, etc. And you don't know how many people this was actually made for. However, cutting out just a square and pulling it out without it looking like it was scooped is perfectly cut square, and then removing that square of the brownie is absolute fucking brilliance. I'd love it. If I would have walked in and seen that, I would have been like, yeah, that is awesome, and laughed my ass off. So the sheer brilliance, the ballsiness, the humor in the approach of cutting one lone center square, I absolutely dismiss all charges against the defendant and would love to buy them a cup of coffee. So ruling is for the defendant, not guilty, right, due to just overall brilliance and execution of dastardly.
All right.
All right, Carrie, do you know what time it is?
What time is it, Nick?
It's time for Blindsided. All right, Carrie. So I figured a great way to wrap up this episode is with a new Blindsided. And for those that don't know how Blindsided works, I'm going to pick a topic. I'm going to ask Carrie a question. She has no idea what the topic is. We may disagree, and if so, there could be some fun there. Or I may, like last time, agree, and it'll be short and sweet. We've discussed the We Are the World project, the documentary, and we even discussed a little bit of the Prince and Michael Jackson rivalry. So, which is it? Michael Jackson or Prince? Who do you prefer? Who's the better artist? And go.
Oh, my God. Feet to the fire? Are you kidding me with this one?
Holy, it's our generation's cow. Beatles versus Stones, man.
I got to go with MJ. I'm going to put this out here. I know there have been lots of
allegations against MJ, all of that aside.
The personal lives, the non-factor, just musically, not because of your social awareness or charges right. or allegations.
I have to go with Michael Jackson. I think Michael Jackson defined a generation. I know people growing up in the 80s who today would not be a Michael Jackson fan, but you know, growing up, they had a glove. I mean, Michael Jackson literally was my childhood. Thriller. And even now, oh my gosh, we have a gymnast who has a routine to Michael Jackson, and it is amazing. I would watch it 100 times in a row if I could. It is fantastic. Absolutely, hands down, has to be Michael Jackson.
I could not disagree with you more. I do understand. I really think this is the modern day Beatles versus Stones. I would imagine if I were to ask you Beatles versus Stones, typically someone that would say Michael Jackson over Prince would say Beatles over Stones. Am I right or wrong there?
Oh, I want you to be wrong, but you're right. I would have to pick Beatles.
Okay. You it's know why?
Personal preference.
It's a personal preference, but I do think that that shows, and I know you have very diverse musical taste. That's one of the things I love about you. You and I have had a lot of exposure to music, but there's definitely more pop influence in your preferences there. Prince, believe it or not, he was really a rock musician, especially at certain stages in his career. I feel he was much more influenced by the bluesy, gritty parts of rock history, something that I think's often overlooked. Prince was a brilliant guitar player. Frigging amazing.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt.
Early in Eric Clapton's career, he was asked by a journalist, how does it feel to be the greatest guitarist alive? And he said, I don't know. You should go ask Jimi Hendrix. And then decades later, he was asked about his career as a guitar player. And he mentioned that he really admired the work of Prince. Prince, I think, was more musically diverse, really more experimental. I think he was more talented. There are some early recordings of his where he played every instrument. I just think his music holds up. He was innovative in the fact that he was one of the first popular musicians to leave a major studio, Warner Brothers, and record his music independently, which even though he didn't sell near as many albums, he paid for money. But I think his contribution to music is much more impactful. And I think you can go back and watch things like Sign of the Times, Raspberry Beret, and those things, which were so much more experimental and I think impactful, that I think Prince just overshadows Michael Jackson tremendously. I don't think Michael Jackson grew much as an artist towards the end.
Yeah, but
performer-wise, Michael Jackson was amazing. And if you have not seen the movie, This Is It, I highly recommend seeing it because it shows what that last tour would have been. And it would definitely have solidified his place in music history even more. He's still an icon. He's still one of the best. But I think Prince slays Michael Jackson in the long run.
You know what, Mac? I feel like you're calling me a basic bitch and I'm offended.
No, and let me be, I mean, that's tough. And it's the same thing. Like, I'm a diehard Stones fan over the Beatles, but I still think the White Album is one of the greatest albums of all time.
Well, let's make no mistake. I mean, Michael Jackson's career was completely cut short for lots of reasons. So, you know, comparison here, let's be careful.
He had to compete with himself and putting out one of the highest selling albums of all time. And I just don't think he rose to the challenge. Yeah. And there are bad Prince albums. There are mediocre Prince albums. And there are some misses there by MJ. But if you look at just Michael versus Prince, I just don't even think it's close. The more I really think about it, we'll agree to disagree. I'm not trying to change your mind, but I'm going to disagree.
I've officially been blindsided.
And you have been blindsided.